Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. On a snowy day in Washington, D.C., we are joined by Benjamin Wittes, who is the editor of Lawfare blog and, of course, the creator of the Little Cannon. You guys all snowed? Is it a snow day in D.C.?
You know, it's a snow day, but not because there's a lot of snow. There's a little bit of snow, and it's not the sort that would shut down Wisconsin.
No, see, this is the thing. There are moments. We had a couple of weeks ago when we had that polar vortex where the entire state of Wisconsin was shut down. But I'm just trying to get a sense of, I'm back in Wisconsin now. I'm trying to get a sense of what shuts down Washington, D.C. First thing this morning, I saw on our Slack page that our offices had been closed. So what? It's like, must be, what, 9-10 inches?
No, it's more like half an inch, an inch. But, you know, I think people thought about a lot of snow and therefore the city shut down.
Okay. Well, I do understand that. And of course, you know, everybody deserves a snow day once in a while. Look, I just feel obligated as a Wisconsinite to mock people in D.C. over these snow days. So Benjamin, we have a lot of things to talk about. And of course, we do need an update on the Cannon. I see that you've actually now created a special stamp. One of these wax stamps.
Yeah, I decided that I needed a wax seal with Baby Cannon on it. So I actually had one custom made. Now if you receive a letter from me that is not sealed with the Baby Cannon seal, I suggest you question whether it's really from me.
Okay. Wow. All right. Or whether you're just not important enough to get the whole seal thing. So I want to talk about the Mueller investigation with you, whether or not it is wrapping up. But first, before we do that, I just want to get your thoughts on the whole Andrew McCabe rollout. We've had the 60 Minutes interview. We've had the book generating a huge amount of debate and discussion back and forth. Just your basic take on all of that, Andrew McCabe. First of all, I'll ask you more specific questions later. But you know, did we learn a lot? What's jumped out at you from those initial interviews?
Well, all right. So Andy McCabe is perhaps the most complicated character in the FBI drama of this period, and let me just lay out the virtues and vices of the guy as candidly as I can. So when Jim Comey was fired, Andrew McCabe stepped up and ran the FBI in a very tumultuous and extraordinarily difficult period. He did it courageously, he did it honorably, and he did it very ably. And we have, I think, Andy McCabe to thank for a lot of good things. He was critical in pressuring Rod Rosenstein into appointing a special counsel, i.e. Bob Mueller. He was, he went up to the Hill days after the president had fired Comey, and then he and Sarah Huckabee Sanders had publicly lied about the reaction to the firing within the bureau. They had sort of flamboyantly lied about it. And Andy McCabe, just days after that happened, went up to the Hill and told the truth about the relationship between the bureau and the former director. And if you look at the period and what happened and the fact that we ended up with a stable investigative, relatively stable investigative climate with an able special counsel's office, I think Andy McCabe has a lot to take credit for in that. And so that's all the good side, right?
Yeah. So there's a lot of buts coming here, right?
Well, there's one big one, which is that Inspector General report that concluded that he had lied repeatedly on an unrelated matter, by the way, involving disclosures to the press and his involvement in those disclosures. That report is largely, almost entirely unrebutted by him, including in these interviews. He says it's not true. but he doesn't present a very cogent defense of himself. And you know, so he is somebody who was found by the IG and dismissed for these findings to have a serious credibility problem. And so I think that does make him a complicated figure here. I don't think he is, you know, he's somebody who you're always going to have a big, how much do we believe Andy McCabe,
yeah,
after you have the conversation. And all that said, I don't see any reason to disbelieve what he's saying, among other things, because on the most significant allegations that he's making, he does seem to have made contemporaneous notes. And Rod Rosenstein, who is the interlocutor in these interactions, or the most important of these interactions, you know, can't even manage to deny them clearly. And so I assume that Andy McCabe's account here is credible and truthful.
You had a blog post in which you're describing the picture that he painted, particularly in the 60 Minutes interview, the chaos that was going on, a chaotic period, one in which everyone was under intense stress, and Rosenstein in particular was handling the stress badly and making erratic judgments.
I think that is very clear from the public record that, you know, this was a period in which Rod believed that, you know, had been used by the president, realized that he was being, that he had been used and was being set up as the guy who was in fact responsible for the Comey firing, which was, you know, really the president's initiative, and also was surprised, and why he should have been surprised, I'm not sure, but he seems to have been surprised to think that people might take it amiss that he participated in the firing of Jim Comey over the Russia, in part, or maybe in whole, over the Russia investigation. And so this is a period in which Rosenstein realizes he has made an unbelievably terrible mistake that is potentially career-ending for him, and is trying to regroup. And there is just, I mean, there have been a number of reports, including in the New York Times, about his fragile emotional state in this period. And I think the stories that Andy McCabe is telling are very consistent with that, you know, that he kind of throws out this idea of invoking the 25th Amendment and kind of starts counting votes for it, and that he, you know, proposes wearing a wire.
What do you make of that? Because the initial pushback on that story when it was first reported was he was just joking about it. McCabe says, no, that they were really serious about it. Which,
so,
of course, now feeds all of the narratives of the deep state and, you know, how out of control the leadership of the FBI and the Department of Justice was, and, you know, the attempted coup and all of that. I mean, it really has fed into that narrative. And even Lindsey Graham, I mean, I don't know, we probably should take out the even Lindsey Graham phrase. Lindsey Graham.
Yeah, I think Lindsey Graham's not an even anymore. He's core Trump base at this point. Look, first of all, I think the McCabe story and actually tends to refute the deep state narrative in the sense that, as McCabe describes it, Rod proposes this. Now, Rod, who is not deep state, right? Rod is a Trump administration, a Trump political appointee as the deputy attorney general, proposes this to two career officials, the acting director of the FBI, a career FBI agent, and the general counsel of the FBI, who's a career official, Jim Baker. And in McCabe's account, Rod proposes that he could wear a wire, and this is not an exact quote, but it's close, the general counsel has a heart attack, and he peels himself off the floor, and he says, we're not there yet. We're not going to do that. We shouldn't do that. We're not there yet. And so it's actually the political appointee who makes the, to the extent that it's an unreasonable proposition or an extravagant proposition, it's the political appointee who makes it. It's the deep state actors who say, no, we're going to rein you back on that, bucko. And so, you know, I actually think the story tends to refute it, the claim. That said, I want to defend Rod on this point. I don't think it was a crazy idea.
Really?
It may be an idea that was premature, or an idea that was that Jim Baker was right to say we're not there yet, we shouldn't do it. But, you know, they were contemplating the idea that the President of the United States was involved in ongoing criminal activity, right? And that was a subject now of an open FBI investigation. And you have somebody who has regular contact with it, who goes over there. Is it crazy for Rod to have floated the possibility that you might have a cooperating witness wear a wire? I think it's undoubtedly right of Jim Baker to say, probably not the best idea. Let's exhaust other possibilities first. But I don't fault Rod for having, you know, among many ideas being thrown around at that time, raising this possibility. I don't think that's outrageous at all.
We also had this story, and I know that you've been advancing this the theory that the obstruction is the collusion. And we had this New York Times report the other day about, you know, the 2-year war on the investigations, intimidation, pressure, and humiliation inside Trump's 2-year war on the investigations encircling him. This story puts a lot of detail on how aggressive this president has been in trying to derail the investigation and how obsessed he is in putting loyalists in charge of this investigation, including, not surprisingly, Matt Whitaker, who did testify under oath that he had not been pressured on the investigations. But now we find out that, in fact, the president suggest putting a loyalist in charge of the Southern District of New York investigations. So talk about your theory that obstruction is the collusion.
All right. I want to disaggregate two separate strains in what you've just described. One is the obstruction is the collusion issue. The second is the war on law enforcement and the war on the investigators. I want to treat those separately. On the obstruction is the collusion theory, I think McCabe's, to me anyway, personally, the most significant aspect of McCabe's interviews has been what he has said on that score, which he made very clear in his 60 Minutes interview and in his conversation with Natasha Bertrand, that there were two separate or interlinked but ultimately separate predicates for the Justice Department's and FBI's opening this investigation on the president. One is the possibility that the president was engaged in criminal obstruction of justice. That's a sort of straight criminal investigation. The other, which is the theory that I outlined in that piece on Lawfare a number of weeks ago, is that in the commission of the obstruction, whether the obstruction is criminal or not, the president was doing it to shut down an investigation that was itself, the shutting down of which was itself a national security problem in the view of the FBI, and maybe being conducted in the service of some foreign power, i.e. Russia. And McCabe was very clear that both of those theories were at work in the FBI's decision to predicate this investigation and open it in the wake of the COVID virus. So I think that is actually a substantial aspect of his coming forward and telling this story, that we're now, the New York Times had reported that this was part of the story, but this is the first time that somebody has kind of one of the principals has come forward and said, yes, we regarded the president's efforts to shut down this investigation as a potential national security problem and that needed to be investigated as a counterintelligence matter. And I do think it's significant that somebody's actually willing to put his name to that. On your other question, which is how should we evaluate the president's war on the investigators? So, look, this has been going on since almost the day of his inauguration. Efforts to pressure, 7 days after his inauguration, he has Jim Comey to dinner at the White House and tells him he needs loyalty, right? So it's really a feature of his presidency from the very beginning, that he wants investigators to be loyal to him. He wants to control investigations he wants to use his control over investigations to protect his friends and himself and his family, and he wants to use his control over investigators to go after his political enemies. And you don't have to believe me about that. He says it out loud whenever he's given a chance. Why aren't they going after Hillary Clinton, right? I admire Eric Holder and the way he protected Barack Obama in the context of Fast and Furious. He even once in a radio interview, I don't have the text in front of me, but he basically said it was the saddest thing that I wrote a long piece on Lawfare about it at the time, that the saddest thing to Donald Trump was that he had discovered as president that he wasn't really supposed to be directing the Justice Department.
Very sad.
It was really sad.
Almost tragic. Really poignant. Yeah.
And so everything the New York Times reported in that story yesterday is just an elaboration of this theme that he believes that he can direct the Justice Department and it's proper and reasonable for him to direct the investigative conduct of the Justice Department for the purpose of rewarding his friends and punishing his enemies. And by the way, if you go to book one of Plato's Republic, where Socrates discusses the conception of what justice is, right? It's the foundational text on what is justice. The first conversation here, Socrates floats the question, what is justice? And one of his interlocutors, I think his name is Polymarchus, proposes as his definition of justice, helping friends and hurting enemies. And the first section of the book is Socrates arguing against that as a conception of justice. If you look at Donald Trump's conception of the Justice Department, it is Polymarchus's conception from book one of the Republic of what justice is.
You perhaps should consider the possibility, just the possibility, that Donald Trump has never actually read Plato.
No, but that's kind of my point. Like, anybody who's read book one of the Republic would instinctively look at somebody, would never say the words, the Justice Department should go after my friends and protect my enemies.
What is fascinating about this is, and we probably need to do this every single time to, you know, describe how abnormal all of this is, the numbing effect of the fact that the president has been doing this in public, as you point out, openly. If we had discovered through tapes or through some other sort of testimony this was going on, it would be a massive, massive scandal. But the fact that it's been happening in broad daylight on a regular basis, and the Times article really sort of alludes to that to a certain extent, that we've become habituated to the fact that the president of the United States, yes, absolutely has been expressing his willingness to abuse his power in this particular way. It's not as if he is attempting to refute it at all. And so to a certain extent, one of his advantages has been the fact that, yeah, I am trying to derail this investigation. Yes, I am interfering in all this. I believe that I have the ability to do all of that.
So I agree with you that his transparency is ultimately his, I wouldn't call it a virtue, but a kind of factor that democratically mitigates the misconduct, in the sense that You know, if you do all this stuff in secret and it comes out, it's a huge scandal, right? If you do it, but if you do it in secret and it doesn't come out, you get away with mm-hmm. it, right? And what Trump does is an intermediate thing, which is he does it sort of quasi in secret, but he also reads the stage directions in public. And so he kind of tells you that he's doing it. And that gives, I think it minimizes the scandalous aspect,
really?
As you say, but it also does, well, it minimizes, you know, in fact, we're less shocked as a result yeah. of his, as you just said, we're less shocked because he does it this way.
So basically, if you do it in the middle of Fifth Avenue, then that is a mitigating circumstance?
Well, so I don't think it's mitigating morally, but I do think it has it creates a democratic mitigation, yes. which is that we get to argue in public. It is unacceptable to have a president who does these things. And the voters actually get to respond to it. Whereas if you do it in secret and you get away with it, the voters never get a chance to do
okay,
that.
Okay, let me give you a
And so yeah, okay. I think you get, we're a little bit less shocked, but if we also all price it into our evaluations of Donald Trump, and for those of us who have an irreconcilable, we will oppose him under any circumstances attitude toward him, one of the reasons, at least in my case, is that I don't think he believes in the rule of law. So I've priced it in a way that I'm irreconcilably opposed to.
You know, I'm trying to get my head around this, whether this is mitigating. There's no question about it that politically, in a lot of ways, this does help him. But you know, I'm trying to think of the reference here. The downside, of course, is that we have a president who's making it very clear he does not support the rule of law, that he has these powers, and so the public is seeing the scandal, and there's a real risk that a large portion of the public will adjust their standards and accept this conduct. And I'm trying to think of the historical analogy of something that a president was doing that we were very fortunate was not revealed, because then, in fact, it might have moved this constitutional window of acceptability, that there's something to be said for, you know, don't make us endorse this bad conduct. So you have, what, 40% of the public?
You sound like Justice Jackson in his Korematsu yeah, opinion.
A little bit.
Right? Where, so, you know, in Korematsu, famed dissent in Korematsu, Justice Jackson basically says there are horrible things you sometimes need to do. You shouldn't ask for judicial permission. The courts should not bless it, right? And you're kind of saying the same thing.
Yes.
It's a really interesting question. Is it better that Trump did these things and get away with them in secret, and so there's no imprimatur of legitimacy on it? Here's the answer. If he is electorally defeated and repudiated, it is much better that it have been happened in the open, triggered the debate, and produced that repudiation. That is a substantial democratic act. On the other hand, if you imagine he gets reelected having done these things, that is a public validation of the act. That's the worst of all possible.
Yes, and that's what raises the stakes now so high. So let's go back to the Mueller investigation. A lot of speculation that it's wrapping up. You saw the tweet from Matt Schlapp, who's married to a senior official in the White House, saying that, well, now that William Barr is the attorney general, he's overseeing the Mueller investigation, Mueller will be gone soon. So do you think that the Mueller investigation is, in fact, wrapping up?
I have mixed instincts about this. On the one hand, the fact that Matt Whitaker, at a press conference as acting attorney general, said it, that he is wrapping up, has to mean something. Mm-hmm. I mean, Matt Whitaker is, after all, in a position to know it. He said it publicly. The Justice Department brass seems to be telling every reporter who comes within 100 yards of the Justice Department that they're expecting a wrap-up of the Mueller investigation. And I think we should take that reasonably seriously. On the other hand, I can think of 7 or 8 factors that give me a little bit of pause on that, and let me tick some of them off. Number one, Mueller extended his grand jury recently for another 6 months. That's not something you do if there's an imminent wrap-up unless there's just a few items of business left, right? Number two, in the recent Paul Manafort hearing, there's a whole lot of material that is redacted from the transcript that presumably is redacted because it relates to ongoing stuff. And by the way, some of which the prosecutors for the Mueller investigation called the heart of the investigation. And so there's clearly still some ongoing investigative activity in the sort of Paul Manafort, Konstantin Kilimnik zone. Number three, there are two, at least, pieces of pending grand jury litigation, one related to this guy, Andrew Miller, who's a Roger Stone associate, and one related to the mystery subpoena to the overseas foreign-owned corporation. So presumably these are litigations that are investigative in character. That is, the grand jury wants some material, testimony, or some documents or something from the mystery company, and you're not going to have a total wrap-up before that's done. Number four, I have seen no evidence, and there has been some reporting that it has not happened, that Don Jr. has yet been interviewed by the investigators. And I cannot imagine the circumstances in which you would want to, given that he was present at the Trump Tower meeting, in which you would want to end the investigation without talking to him. Now, is it possible? Sure, it's possible. It's a little bit hard for me to understand how that would be appropriate. Number five, the Mueller investigation presented Jerome Corsi with a draft plea agreement, which Jerome Corsi then declined and leaked to the press. I don't believe responsible prosecutors offer a plea agreement to somebody that they are not prepared to indict. And the Mueller people are responsible prosecutors. And so I'm perplexed by the absence of an indictment of Jerome Corsi, and I have to assume that one is probably forthcoming in some way. And so I could go on. Yeah. There's a few other of these threads that are all, they're not inconsistent with the idea that a wrap-up could be happening, but they are also indicative of we're not quite done yet. And so my assumption is that there are threads to wrap up, that and wrapping things up can take some time, but that there's some truth to the underlying story that we're in the end stages of the investigation. Now, a separate and important question is, what does that mean? Yeah. Does that mean we're in we've drafted the whole indictment, we've drafted the whole report, and it's just a question of plopping it on Bill Barr's desk, shutting down the Office of Special Counsel and referring all pending business back to DOJ components? Or is the argument that you've finished the investigative phase and now is the time that you make decisions about that you have deferred about whether certain people do or do not get prosecuted? And so I think the question of what it means to be wrapping up may be just as important as the question of whether he is in fact wrapping it up. In The Hustler, the great Paul Newman movie, there's a great line where Paul Newman pool player character says, "The game is over when Minnesota Fats was his opponent." It says it's over. And that's actually the way I feel about this. The game is over when Bob Mueller said.
And of course, this doesn't affect the Southern District of New York investigations or the congressional investigations. The two witnesses that potentially could bring this the closest to the President Roger Stone and Paul Manafort clearly not cooperating with the special counsel. And their behavior is in so many ways not just erratic, but very difficult to understand unless, well, I'll ask you this, you know, to what extent do you think the prospect, the hope, the wink and a nod that they might get a pardon is impacting their willingness to face lengthy prison terms rather than cooperate with Bob Mueller?
So I don't know what is motivating Paul Manafort in any sense.
It doesn't make sense.
And I think it does not make sense. It is an absolutely irrational set of behaviors for a criminal defendant who is, trying to maximize his own gain or minimize his own loss. And certainly the theory that he is playing for a pardon is as viable as any theory. Another possibility is he is not a rational actor, you know, and people do behave irrationally sometimes. And so I do think he's been, it is well worth considering the possibility that he is playing for a pardon and that Trump is dangling one in front of him. There's some considerable public evidence of that. To what extent that's the dispositive factor in his behavior versus just criminals behaving irrationally, I do not know. Roger Stone is a little bit of a different case because he's at a very early stage of criminal proceedings, and a lot of people talk tough at the early stage of criminal proceedings. Those of us who have spent a lot of time watching, you know, tough guy acts in criminal proceedings melt into plea agreements and cooperating witnesses always have a certain skepticism of the tough guy act. That said, he may mean it. It's kind of his persona. This is how he rolls. And so with him, we'll just have to see. I do think for the president actually to pardon either of these two people, particularly Manafort, would be politically catastrophic for him.
And probably an impeachable offense. Okay, in the few minutes we have left, Clarence Thomas, what Clarence Thomas did yesterday, if you had any thoughts on all of this, takes the occasion to suggest that the U.S. Supreme Court should revisit and perhaps overturn Times versus Sullivan, which, of course, is the key case dealing with libel laws. He's not joined by anybody else in the court, but I guess I would throw out, don't assume that that is simply an outlier. I think that the Thomas's attack after Trump has made this issue public over and over again is really the opening shot in what could be a very sustained attack on a crucial aspect of First Amendment litigation.
So I agree with you, and I don't. So let me say that. First of all, the idea of revisiting Times v. Sullivan is absurd, and particularly doing so at a time that the president is attacking the press and talking about how libel laws should be revisited and changed is, at a minimum, exceedingly ill-advised for Justice Thomas and, you know, certainly risks presenting himself as carrying president's water for him.
But you could certainly imagine other conservatives in the legal community picking up on this. I mean, I would not be surprised if some of your friends in the Federalist Society begin saying, well, Justice Thomas has a point here.
So agreed. I do think, however, it is important to just note and how much weight you put on it. Clarence Thomas has a history of doing exactly this, which is saying in a concurrence to a cert denial or a concurrence to an opinion, I agree with the majority that under relevant Supreme Court precedent, sometimes 150 years old, this is the right outcome. I write separately to note that in the appropriate case, we should revisit this age-old precedent that we all assume was non-negotiable. And he does this fairly frequently because he is the only member of the Supreme Court in any of our lifetimes, I think, who really doesn't believe in stare decisis at all in constitutional matters. And it was one of the big divisions between him and Justice Scalia. And, you know, so in his own weird way, Clarence Thomas is being consistent here, which is, you know, he doesn't believe in a lot of old precedents, and he generally flags that he doesn't in exactly this way. So I will say, in Clarence Thomas's defense, he is behaving absolutely the way he normally behaves here. And whether it's a tone deafness with respect to how proposing revisiting Times v. Sullivan would appear in the current climate, or whether he's doing it cynically by way of making the president happy, I certainly venture no opinion. But I do think it is worth noting that it's at least consistent with the way he normally behaves.
Well, I hope that that's the case, because given the antipathy for the media, which is a pre-existing condition long before Trump, but the way that it has been ramped up, I could certainly see this at least getting more political traction at the moment. And in the back of my mind, and maybe you don't want to address this, but the cloud over Thomas created by, and how do you say this delicately? How do I get into the whole Ginny Thomas thing? I mean, you know, without crossing all kinds of lines, is there any precedent for the spouse of a Supreme Court justice being so overtly partisan and activist, so closely tied to the administration as we have with Ginny Thomas? And of course, you know, you and I have no idea whether she's influencing his jurisprudence or whether she's influencing this, but, you know, this comes after these reports of her meeting with the president and, you know, becoming much, much more outspoken sort of on the fringes of right wing politics. And then you have Justice of the Supreme Court throwing out something like this. You know, whether we talk about it or not, it's in the back of our minds, isn't it?
So first of all, I think it's perfectly fair to talk about it. I mean, Ginny Thomas is a conservative activist and public figure. And while she is perfectly entitled to her political activism and to her opinions about things and to her involvement in whatever issues she wants to get involved with, it is perfectly reasonable for other people to scratch their heads and say, what questions does this raise about Justice Thomas's impartiality when those issues happen to dovetail with issues that come before the Supreme Court? And, you know, I think at the end of the day, Justice Thomas's work product has to stand on its own two feet, but he and his wife are both surely aware that her behavior and involvement in these questions will cause people to read his opinions a little bit differently, particularly in an area like this, than they might otherwise do. And I don't think that's different from, I don't think there's anything inappropriate about that. I think when you have somebody who is as actively involved as she is, it's going to raise questions about his, you know, about to what extent there is interplay between her activity and his work. And the answer may be there is none. He's comes to all of these entirely on his own. And but he can't possibly expect not to have people scratch their heads.
They invite this kind of conversation we're having right now. Benjamin Wittes, the editor-in-chief of Lawfare Blog, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thank you so much for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast. Appreciate it very, very much. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.